Sunday, January 30th, Leonard and I went out into a Washington, white and silent, blanketed under 8 inches of snow, drifts piled many feet high by the wind. We went to the Red Mass, St. Matthew's Cathedral, Lucy and Pat with us, Vanderburg snugly at home in bed, and heard Archbishop O'Boyle compare Lyndon's situation in Asia to George Washington at Valley Forge. And at the end he said, "As you leave this morning, you take with you our respect, our affection, and our confidence." It was a sparse congregation, not more than 200 persons, and it usually draws most of the cabinet, the court, a heavy contingent of the House and Senate, and a big group from the diplomatic corps. Only the most faithful, the Speaker, of course, and Mrs. McCormick were there. About 40 minutes late, the Chief Justice and Mrs. Warren came in. As we sat on the front row, I stared down at the very center of the aisle, where there was a legend saying approximately this: "Here rested the remains of President John Fitzgerald Kennedy during the funeral mass preceding their removal to Arlington, where they await the joyous day of resurrection." Somehow the pronouns "they" and "their" seemed to rob Kennedy the man of being an individual, a human, and put him another, a stranger, a colder classification. The sermon was on Sir Thomas More. I never knew before that he was a saint, and it was as good a sermon I ever heard, and about as interesting a human predicament and human reaction. From the church, we went to the Valentis. Lennon had been talking all morning with Jack about House Gatto. In the days that I've been in New York, little Corey, as she calls herself, has acquired a cat, Gatto, and she and Gatto have paid daily visits to Lyndon in his office, furnishing laughter and relaxation, often in the midst of the most unexpected surroundings, such as cabinet meetings and chiefs of staff in full regalia. Sure enough, at the Valentis, the snow was piled hip-high, the narrow lane about 12 inches wide, shoveled much earlier that morning by Jack. It was hilarious to try to walk through. I borrowed a pair of size 12 boots, stepped out of them, and plunged laughing into the snow. Inside, we had hot coffee and a few moments for Corey to climb all over Lyndon and say, "I love prayers," while Lucy and Pat and I and her parents were their ardent claqueurs in the play. Then back at the White House, we had an omelet lunch with the children. Then Lyndon lay down for a nap and much, much reading of papers and great folders of night reading. Lyndon's guests, John and Vince Loftus, who'd been coming from Texas in the storm for several days by car, train, and bus, had gotten as far as Alexandria about 7 o'clock Sunday morning and had been snowbound all day. About 7, I went down to the pool, having tried unsuccessfully to get Lyndon from his office to join me. And then, after I'd had about 20 laps, a phone call, he was coming, bringing Mac George Bundy with him. The Bill Whites, whom we'd invited to dinner, sat on the edge and had a drink while I completed the last of my 30 laps and listened to Lyndon and Mac George. All day there had been the air of excitement that goes through the house when something is afoot, when a decision has been made. We were going to resume bombing. Probably we would hear something by 6 or 7 o'clock. But in the pool, Lyndon got a call. He came back and said to Mac George, "Bad weather. It'll be midnight before we hear." Harrowing though it is, during the time of making a decision, there is a relief, a relaxation afterward, still without knowing whether it is right or wrong. It's like the end of physical exertion. You've learned all you can, weighed everything, and decided. And then before the tenseness sets in again, there is a period of relief. So it was while we swam. Bill White and Mac and I had a scotch, and Lyndon his ubiquitous Dr. Pepper, one calorie. Mac George is the most charming company, one of the most articulate and delightful human beings I've ever met. He and Linda have a particular affinity for each other. She came in to show us a white lace bikini covered by a little girl dress with a great pink sash. As we swam, we talked of the next day's events. By morning, the resumption of bombing would be known. Also, we were going into the United Nations, to the Security Council, through Ambassador Goldberg, asking them to bring the full weight of their influence and authority to bear on the Vietnam question. I feel that I and millions of other women have never quite understood why the United Nations couldn't shoulder more of the burden, couldn't solve more of the problem before now. Patiently, Lyndon and MacGeorge explained to me, at least this is what I learned from their talk, that since neither North Vietnam or China are members of the United Nations, and since Russia's attitude would be very much of a question mark, the chance of its being a real forum, a real tool toward success, was very slim. But I think in the eyes of the public, it is good that we are going to the United Nations, because we mustn't leave a stone unturned, a door unknocked on. So tomorrow, these two big efforts start. We'd spent much of the afternoon looking at TV shows. One, members of Congress discussing Vietnam. Hale Boggs, very ably. Senators Mutt, Joe Clark, Stennis of Mississippi, and Senator Morse, quite wildly. So tomorrow, the double-pronged effort begins. Tonight, it was warm and pleasant in the West Hall. Mac and Bill Moyers and the Bill Whites and the Emmett Reardons. Linda Bird returned from the station, having finally rescued John Loftus and Vincent, his brother, from the snow. They're the first real college type she'd had dates with. Good-looking, muscular, quiet. John studying petroleum land management. Lyndon in the pool had teased Linda not to get interested in anybody who was studying petroleum land management. What we needed was somebody that was studying goats. Somebody that could make the Scharnhorst pay. Lyndon was in high good humor. To be back on a course of action, we have reached a decision, is a release for him, no matter how agonizing the situation may be or the course uncertain. The city was still held tight in the grip of the storm, and more snow was promised for Monday. So I called Liz and told her we had better cancel the reception for the hanging of Mrs. Roosevelt's portrait on Monday afternoon. It was a sleepless night for Lyndon. I was vaguely aware when he called the Situation Room, off and on during the night, and then at 6 o'clock he was bolt upright with the light on and the radio going. So I heartlessly left for the snug cocoon of my own bed. It will take years to catch up on the sleep he's lost in the White House.